From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Some musical performances fall on deaf ears. Others make people just wish that they were deaf.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what's...
This morning we head into the break room to talk about Fergie's disastrous rendition of the national anthem. That's ahead this hour. But we spent part of yesterday's show talking about legislation to ban pit bulls following high-profile pit bull attacks. Emily Patterson-Kane of the American Veterinary Medical Association says that kind of policy may have a short-term effect, but it doesn't necessarily prevent dog attacks.
If somebody likes to have a dangerous dog, then they're going to go out and get themselves a German Shepherd or a Mastiff or something else. Part of the danger is that you're not actually addressing the responsible person, who is in fact not the dog, but is the person.
We, of course, have a lot of animal lovers who listen to our show. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is William Stewart. I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm calling because I worked at a vet clinic for a couple of years, both in the kennels and as a vet tech. And my parents currently own a Presa Canario, variation of Mastiff, which is frequently known to be, quite vicious. They look like a giant pit bull. You know, you just have to get to know the specific animal, and it absolutely had to do with the kind of experiences that they had in their lives, not the breed.
And we always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. This week, the National Football League teamed with Atlanta's Morehouse College for a workshop on activism. Inspired by Colin Kaepernick's kneeling response to shootings by police, the workshop was designed to equip athletes with tools and resources necessary to make social change in respectful and responsible ways. 50 years ago this year, two Olympic athletes demonstrated their activism. Track stars Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists in a Black Power salute during the medal ceremony. Both were honored at the White House in 2016 by then President Barack Obama. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with John Carlos when that happened.
It took 48 years, I guess, for a president to honor the message that you sent. Do you feel like that was too long? Or did you ever at any point in time feel like, you know, we still haven't come around on this?
Well, it took 48 years for them to acknowledge John Carlos and Tommy Smith. Look how long it took for them to acknowledge the 1936 black athletes that represented the United States. You know, the 36 team went to the Olympic Games. It's just that the black athletes upon that team was not allowed to go. So, you know, we still have some problems, some adjustments that we need to make. I thank Mr. Obama. I thank him. Appreciate him, and I respect him for his courage to break the tide, so to speak, and invite us to the White House. You know, rather than say it took too long, I always like to use the phrase better late than never.
So yours was a silent protest, and it has reminded a lot of people of, Colin Kaepernick's protest, which is also silent, has reminded a lot of people of what you did nearly half a century ago. What is the purpose of a silent protest on the part of an athlete? And I ask that knowing that a lot of people have criticized Colin Kaepernick, saying, you know, you're an athlete, you need to stick to your sport.
Well, that's a stupid statement. That's a stupid statement. That's the same stupid-ass statement that they made 48 years ago. How do you tell an individual that you are suspended from society because you're an athlete, that you shouldn't have any concerns about the well-being of those individuals that you grew up with in your community, those individuals that don't have decent housing, those individuals that get killed in the street, those individuals that can't go to universities or colleges, those individuals that can't get a decent job, health care. How can they tell him he's an athlete and he has no business dealing with issues confronting society? That's like telling a minister he's not supposed to go to church on Sunday.
What kind of advice would you give him on withstanding that? This is something, the kind of criticism that you've had to hold your head up through. What advice would you give him?
Only advice I would give him is tell him to stand fast to what he believes in, and he has a clear understanding as to what he did and why he did it or why he's continuing to do it. I think that he's set a precedent amongst the many athletes start to stand and realize that I can assert my manhood, I can assert my womanhood for justice and equality. You know, when you sit back and you think about individuals dying just merely because someone has the power to kill them and get away with it, there's no need or no given right for anyone to be silent about that treatment. You know, it's ridiculous. I'm sure the white society, if they saw the number of, you know, white individuals lose their lives like those black people that we saw in the last 3-4 years die, blatantly taking their lives, I'm sure this nation would be in an uproar from the white society here in the United States. So why are they so upset because a black man choose to say, I'm disenchanted about we losing so many black kids or black adults or black period by the hands of law enforcement? Now, he never stated that all law enforcement is bad. What he stated is that law enforcement has some cracks in its armor. Law enforcement has some broken members in the Blue Shield, and they need to go and weed them out. All he's doing is telling them, say, hey, man, you got a cut on your leg. You need to get it fixed. You need to get a Band-Aid. You need to try and stop the bleeding.
So what have you heard from ensuing generations? I have to assume that other athletes, other African-Americans, other Americans, period, have come and talked about the impact that your message had on them. What do you hear from people?
Everyone is give more respect and admiration for what Dr. Smith, Peter Norman, and I did. I think they realized the consequences of what we did. I think that they got a lot of inner strength out of it. I think it took a long time for them to really digest and hold on to it in terms of having pride for yourself and having a right to step up when you feel that you're being misused or abused.
Is that what you think? Do you have any thoughts about how you might have changed that moment? Any thoughts about what you were thinking at the time and how your thinking may have evolved since then?
My whole process was to apply some shock treatment. You know, my whole process was to apply shock treatment to society, to wake them up, black and white, and whomever we came in between, to make them realize that these social issues that we have is destroying this nation, is destroying this world. And you have the right to step up and say, I'm tired of it. Something needs to be done. That was a cry that we did on that victory stand.
So, you know, you guys are among a certain group of athletes who have taken activist stands. Muhammad Ali, of course, a number of other athletes. And I wonder if you think the Obama administration was supporting the idea of the athlete activist by choosing to honor you now at this very moment where we're having this national discussion about Colin Kaepernick.
No, I think that Mr. Obama decided that he was on his way out of office. I mean, he acknowledged us in the past at the ESPYs. You know, Mr. Kaepernick wasn't about at that time.
Yeah.
I think the fact is that Mr. Obama is leaving office, and he wanted to make a statement with the Olympic Committee relative to our involvement in the Olympics and a message to society.
So do athletes, because of their position, successful athletes, because of their position as, in some cases, celebrities, do they have an obligation to speak up on social matters?
You know, they have obligation. When they can wait until their mama get hit across the head or get killed because they came to the wrong house? You darn tootin', they have obligation. You know, and for individuals such as Shaq and Jerry Rice changed his mind. But I see all the naysayers out there. And the question is, down the line, how are they going to come out in history? Which side of the road are they going to be classified on that day when it's determined that those individuals that fought for justice and equality and respect, they will understand what it's all about. They will get pinched in life to realize that, hey, you know, I made a statement against this young individual, and I didn't think it clearly through. All I thought about was dollars. See, and most individuals that make those statements, they make those statements because they're wrapped up with dollars, and they think it's all about dollars. Once again, as I stated, once they get to the point where they realize that Shaq's mother doesn't have her name on his head, his kids don't have his name tattooed on his forehead for the police or anyone to see that that's Shaq's son. All they're going to see is black skin. Then these guys are going to be able to understand. Let me give you, for instance, what I'm talking about. Here we have a guy named Deion Sanders, great person, great athlete. I believe he's a minister.
Yeah, former Dallas Cowboy. Yeah,
right. Made a tremendous amount of money. Gives his son a platinum credit card. Here, son, go do your thing. Son goes to a major department store to go in, and he saw a couple of belts that he liked. The belts was extremely expensive. He tells a woman, I want two of these belts, and he gives her his card. His name is on it. He hasn't broken any law. Because he's a black individual with a platinum credit card, she pushes the button. Next thing, the police come to cart this kid off like he's some sort of criminal. So based on the color of your skin, you know, these are things that are still prevalent today that we have to wipe out. You know, it's a difference if you, I don't know your ethnic background, but if you was a white woman and you walk down the street and you say, oh, I'm looking for a house, and you see the sign down the street, you know, said vacancy. Well, you can come on. They look at your complexion. They say, come on. But if I'm the same person walking down the street looking for that same house, they see what color I am. By the time I got there, the vacancy sign then went from vacant to occupied.
And the incident with Oprah Winfrey and the purse happened in Switzerland. But there are people saying, for example, Serena Williams has come out to protest publicly against police brutality and says she will become more active in the future. And yet some people have said that she needs to be careful because she'll lose endorsements. This will hurt her career if she becomes more than an athlete and becomes an activist.
Let me just say this. And I want to be very clear about this. It's not about the money. That's what Mr. Kaepernick is saying right now. You know, when I made my statement 28, 48 years ago, I had $13 in my bank account. This young man had $13 million in his account. He's showing the rest of the athletes, this is not about how much money you have or how much money you don't have. You know, Serena, I'm sure she will survive if they took the endorsements away from her. I'm sure Mr. Kaepernick will survive if they took the endorsements away from her. If they feel that, you know, that they're going to move her away from endorsements because she chose to stand up for what's right in society, I don't need those products anyway, if that's the attitude those individuals have, because it makes me think maybe behind closed doors, those sponsors might have a different view about how society should be run.
That's Olympic bronze medal winner John Carlos. He lives in Georgia. He and fellow Olympic track athlete Tommy Smith sparked an international debate by raising their fists during the 1968 medal ceremony. Carlos spoke with Celeste Headlee in 2016. A workshop this week in Atlanta that's sponsored by Morehouse College and the National Football League centers on activism among professional athletes. Just ahead, the Break Room Gang rates Fergie's national anthem performance. But first, guitarist Eric Johnson returns to Atlanta. It's On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa in for Celeste Headlee. It's possible that you have not heard about guitarist Eric Johnson, but there's a very good chance you have heard this tune at least once. That was the song Cliffs of Dover. Eric Johnson stunned the world with that tune in 1990, putting him forever on the map of great guitar players. The Austin, Texas-based musician has shared the stage with the likes of Cat Stevens, Mike Stern, Steve Vai, and Joe Satriani. He's now on tour and plays Atlanta tomorrow. Producer Trevor Young caught up with Eric Johnson last year.
Hey, this is Eric Johnson. I'm a guitar player, singer, pianist from Austin, Texas. Looking forward to coming to Atlanta. I would say almost every single song I've ever tried to, well, I'm going to write this and try to make it a successful song or something the audience is really going to dig or something, you know, like it always sounds like it's contrived almost. The songs that I've had that people seem to appreciate the most are the ones that just kind of are more inspired and they kind of just kind of happen because maybe that's the energy from where they came originally. I think it's more just what kind of comes to you and kind of trying to be true to that. And I find that whatever kind of comes to me inspiring wise and then trying to be a facilitator, like almost like I'm staying in the back seat, directing the route maybe, but not trying to drive the car too much. I like the song Trail of Tears. I wrote that with Carla Olson. It's, you know, about the Native Americans and their turmoil of traveling 1,500 miles from Carolinas to Oklahoma. I thought maybe that's a worthwhile story to tell, which many people have in different ways.
Take me from prison, bound chains. I'm a suspended once again.
When I was very, very young, you know, I would listen to my dad sing or play records. And one thing that happened is he'd play all different types of music. He just loved music. And it became kind of entrenched in me that music is beautiful. Not, oh, polka music or rap music or classical music or music where somebody has 2.5 guitars and a, you know, a bass drum on, you know, I mean, it was just music is music. It's beautiful, you know, and it's a matter of the spirit behind it. So I'd be very hard pressed to critique music and say, well, this is not good because it's not the color I like, you know. It's a matter of whether it has a spirit or not. And if it does, it kind of supersedes the style. Something I've always done in my private life is played acoustic guitar and piano and wrote songs and stuff. And I guess when I first started doing my first records and it became what I got known for is, you know, doing playing electric guitar in and of itself. And so I just kind of went with that. And I guess in the last years, I've thought, well, you know, I'd like to kind of show more of every side of me that I can. Well, I think if you just sit down in the room by yourself and you just slowly play some stuff you play and then you think about what you want to play and you try this picking technique or that thing, you very quickly find out you really don't know as much as you might want to think you do. I mean, you got your bag of tricks, but if you try to approach something a little different or different picking or different, there's like, oh, wow. And you can feel the friction to trying to play it in a flowing, effortless way. So there's always something to work on to kind of get more free to where you can just play anything. Whatever you learn, whatever you build musically, you want it to be music that people can appreciate, not necessarily stuff that people just marvel at.
That was Austin guitarist Eric Johnson. He performs at Atlanta's Center Stage tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Well, it's been a long week. We've traced the history of HBCUs, fought off the flu, and went on a date to the Waffle House. So, as we do every Friday, we've gathered up a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what happened this week. It's time for the break room.
And we can prevent some seriously nasty crimes and some seriously indescribable tragedies. And if somebody doesn't want to do that at this point, that's pathetic.
Tell me something. What do you know about Wakanda?
Let our flag war still there.
She did better than I would have done. Joining us in the break room are Natalie Pavelski, Vice President of Cater Communications, Greg Williams, mortgage banker and host of the conservative radio show Greg's List, Amber Scott, Executive Director of the nonprofit Leap Year, and Hector Fernandez, Professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
After last week's mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, students nationwide have been rallying for more gun control. President Trump has indicated that he's open to some things. He's open to banning bump stocks. These are the things that allow a semiotic automatic rifle to sort of function kind of like an automatic rifle, like a machine gun. He's also open to tightening the federal background check system, which has a lot of holes in it. How do we think that this might play out in Georgia? Like other states, Georgia sends the names of people who have been involuntarily hospitalized for mental health or substance abuse reasons here to the FBI's gun background check database. Georgia is the only state that removes those names after 5 years without any new mental health assessment. Might we see some bipartisan movement on this issue locally? Greg, what do you think?
I hope so. I mean, some of his ideas, I think, are certainly bipartisan in nature, especially, you know, since the AR-15 has been deemed as, you know, the weapon of war that everybody's using hyperbole against. If he raises that age to 21, I think that that's a fair starting point for the negotiation. There's some on the left that'll never be happy until every gun is confiscated, but I think we can try to meet somewhere in the middle where, you know, fans of the NRA can agree that we have a problem with this 18 to 21 age bracket that for some reason chooses AR-15, and that has turned into some horrific incidents, some terroristic incidents is what we really need to be calling it at some of our schools. And also the point of doing the mental health checks, of course. I think that's an obvious point of concession that all folks need to make, and we need to invest in more treatment.
That's just a start, though. I mean, the AR-15, it's not hyperbole, Greg. This is the civilian version of a military weapon designed specifically to kill as many people as possible. Nobody needs that.
But it's not just the AR-15.
It's other things as well.
It is a semi-automatic rifle that's dressed up to look like something you would use in battle. It's largely a cosmetic distinction between the AR-15 and semi-automatic hunting rifles. If you just ban the one that looks scary, does that have any effect? Aren't people just going to reach for the one that looks like a hunting rifle?
Because it is the weapon of choice for mass killers of children and others, go ahead and ban it. I'd also say Greg's right about raising the age and expanding the mental health piece of this. But also, we don't need bump stocks. We don't need huge magazines. We don't need to allow kits that turn a normal gun into a full automatic. This is crazy making. All of these ideas need to be on the table, and they in no way infringe Second Amendment rights.
Even for hunting, you don't need a semi-automatic weapon for hunting. And in Georgia, we need a lot more. I mean, it's just crazy. It's the right to bear arms is becoming the obligation to bear arms. I mean, and that's just not the way it works. There's also the right, if you want to, not to have a gun. And a sizable percentage of the population, even in Georgia, feels like we do not need and we do not want the guns.
Yeah, I get frustrated with this argument, and Marco Rubio made this argument at the town hall as well, around like, well, we can't make this ban on this particular kind of gun because you can always kind of get around that. But it's more than just, you know, you can always find some way to circumvent the system, but it's about sending a message that as a country, we care about this issue and we're going to do something.
Right,
like,
and
we're
there
going
is a
to do something.
But there is a practical thing, too. For example, when's the last time we had a flamethrower massacre? You can't remember because flamethrowers are banned. Okay, theoretically, you could get around around it and get a flamethrower. But the fact that we don't have flamethrowers
we did have a pressure cooker used as a bomb at the Boston Marathon.
And
we've had plenty of trucks being driven into large crowds.
We had trucks driven into large crowds all across D.C. They installed those little barriers around the city. Yeah. So immediately they were
D.C. armed itself against weaponized vans.
No, they put up defensive postures. They put up things in the street.
I could argue that concealed carry is a defensive posture.
Oh, come on. Everybody thinks that carrying a gun is going to turn themselves into this fabulous...
There was an armed guard standing for 4 minutes outside of the school. That was a good guy with a gun.
Death Wish is coming back. Bruce Willis is in the remake of Death Wish, so I think we're going to see the rise of vigilantism.
And Ronson is rolling over in his tomb thinking about what a poor job he's doing.
Everybody thinks that having a gun is going to magically turn them into a fabulous marksman with great bravery. You know, we're all just a bunch of schlubs. I mean, that's a ridiculous idea.
That actually means that we probably need more high-capacity magazines because you ain't going to be dirty, hairy in your accuracy.
Really? That's going to help a lot.
Turn our schools into shooting galleries.
You know, our president's idea that this notion that teachers should also be armed and not focusing, they're already under-resourced and under-supported, and trying to teach our children algebra, but they should also be like Okeyo from Black Panther, the general, like, ready to...
And I went to Catholic school, so the thought of arming nuns is really scary.
Oh, God. That's a good point.
All right, folks. Well, if that conversation was any indication, I'm sure we're very close to bipartisan agreement.
Yeah, we're the majority.
Right after the Parkland massacre, a very vocal group of students went on television to demand action on this issue. Let's listen.
If they say that criminals get guns no matter what laws you have in place, that might be true, but we don't have to encourage them to get those guns. We can make it harder.
Every answer is a solution at this point because we haven't tried any of them, and we need a multifaceted approach to this extremely complex problem, because if we don't have that, this will never come to an end.
Those were students Emma Gonzalez and David Hogg on CNN. An aide to Florida State Representative Sean Harrison was fired this week after claiming that those students were paid actors. That was not true, but he was not the only person to say something like that. Plenty of people still believe that Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre was something that was faked. Where do we think that these theories come from? What are they a response to?
I think a sizable percentage of gun owners are so enamored of their weapons that they failed to conceive the notion that many of us do not need or, you know, want weapons in our life. And besides, it's really hard to imagine that you want a weapon when you conceive it as latent violence. You know, the weapon is just there, resting, waiting to cause harm and kill someone. And that's not attractive
at all. That's one interpretation. I suppose I wonder if maybe one reason why people reach for conspiracy theories is that it makes them feel less in danger to believe that these things aren't actually happening to real people.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think people really cling to these false narratives because if they don't, then they have to accept the fact that someone did walk into a school and murder children with in a very horrible, violent way. And they would have to really sit with that and reflect on it and kind of deal with that immense tragedy. And I think it's so much easier to just be like, no, that didn't happen. These people are actors, and, you know, and send death threats to these poor parents, you know, these poor survivors, instead of really just accepting that this happened and this is a real problem in our country. And we should do something about it.
Yeah, well, back to the original question about why do people think this, I think it goes back to we really have an institutional distrust these days, right? The media has gotten it turned into fake news. I almost think they're going to have a push to regulate journalism in the future because we see how much fake news is being pushed out there.
And how much real
news
is being called fake news, uncorrected.
But you also look at it immediately after the shooting, the next day CNN and many other stories ran that this guy was a white nationalist, and it turned out that story was false, and George Chitty, who's been on the show before, tracked it back and said that was actually started by white nationalists, so it would further erode trust in journalism. So we've got a lot of things going on in this country, and another reason people think is because of this false flag alert that a lot of folks think that sometimes the government is intentionally trying to create chaos in order to steal our rights. Now, yes, that's paranoid and conspiracy theorists, but it's a reality for some people out there.
And it's been part of our history for a while now. I mean, you saw this after 9/11. You've seen it going back decades. But it really underlines, doesn't it?
The JFK, think about that.
And that's the problem, isn't it? Because if we can't even agree what the truth is, what chance do we have as a divided nation of coming to agreement about the solution?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we also don't want people to just kind of determine truth by consensus. Sometimes the truth is in question, and we have to be honest about that.
Yeah, but not in these cases. I mean, there's some really ugly stuff out on Facebook attacking these poor kids who just went through this terrible tragedy. And it's ugly and awful. And there's no doubt about it. These kids are kids who've just come through a terrible tragedy. Some of them are very media savvy, and I think the older generation doesn't understand that. I mean, these are kids who already... You know, that's how you live your life. You post stuff on Facebook, or you go live, or you tweet, or you Snapchat. And I think, you know, yeah, they're going to be more polished than an older person caught in the same situation. But that's just because of the generation they're in.
Yeah, did you see Emma Gonzalez? I mean, she rocked. I mean, how can anyone think that she's an actress? I mean, makes no sense at all.
We'll have to leave it there, Hector. It's Friday. We are in the break room. And just ahead, could you ever go on a date with someone of the other political party? Also, strap in because the Atlanta airport has flights to Wakanda.
Let's go.
The fake African nation from the Black Panther movie. We'll talk more about the week's news with our break room gang just after the break. It's on Second Thought. There she is. There's Fergie. I'm Adam Ragusea. This is On Second Thought. We're having coffee and conversation in the break room as we do each Friday. My guests are Hector Fernandez, professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. Natalie Pavelski, vice president of Cater Communications. Greg Williams, mortgage banker and host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. And Amber Scott, executive director of the nonprofit Leap Year. You gotta give it to Fergie. She knows how to get attention. Let's listen to a little bit more of that performance of the Star Spangled Banner from the NBA All-Star game last weekend. Oh, I'm told that we don't have the clip, so let me see if I can.
It was so bad.
Well, let's try to put a finer point on it. Was it bad in the sense that it was ill-conceived, like the entire arrangement and the approach was just tasteless? Or had she nailed the vocal, had it been like super in tune and really, really good, would we have allowed her the license to do something so, shall we say, edgy?
She sexed it up. I mean, she has all the right, because artists, you know, they're entitled to push the envelope.
Sex up the national anthem.
It's a symbol of the state.
I don't understand.
Hendrix did it. Fergie can do it, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, artists, when you attack such a performance, you're failing to understand somebody's right to interpret the symbols of the state, and it shows a bit of lack of understanding of the relationship between the idea of nation and the physicality of the state. So, I mean, she has all the right to do whatever she wants.
Yeah, and Amber has the right to think that she did a terrible job.
Hey, I understand.
I don't. I mean, I think there's a lot of sexism in the response to the performance. I mean, it read bluesy to me, not like inappropriately Marilyn-esque. Yeah, and besides, it's Fergie we're talking about.
Marvin Gaye did a sexy national anthem,
and it is
legendary to this day.
Yes.
And the thing is, it is Fergie we're talking about. I mean, this woman probably, you know, sleeps in her stilettos, okay? What did they expect?
It's not her fault
that the basketball player on the Jumbotron had his jaw on the floor. I mean, that's not her problem.
Art is art, so to speak, and everybody can now be a critic. That was actually the first time I had heard it. I wasn't able to watch the live performance.
The Star Spangled Banner?
Somewhere, yeah, it's the first time I've ever heard that song. But no, the Fergie version, and I mean, somewhere Roseanne Marr must be like, wow, I was very close to not having the worst performance ever. But that was different.
That was disrespectful. This was an artistic choice, and for a lot of people it misfired.
I mean, my thing is, you know, as a country, as we just saw in our conversation about guns, right, there are very few things that we are all on the same page about, and like, this is the one thing. This is our anthem that we can all like. Yes,
Hendrix got crucified when he did what he did, and now everybody loves it.
If Marvin can do it, Fergie can do it.
Yeah, I suppose I come back to my original implied conclusion, which is that if she had stuck the landing, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. Like, you can get away with a lot if you do it really, really unimpeachably well, and she didn't. All right, okay. Moving on to other issues of great significance. Most of the nation agrees that Marvel's Black Panther movie is awesome.
If anyone found out what we truly are, what we possess, it could destroy the world.
Show me my respect.
It is my duty to protect it.
And bow down.
My son, this is your time.
Now, the Atlanta airport got a lot of attention after tweeting a picture of a departing flight ostensibly headed to Wakanda. The weird thing about that is that Wakanda does not exist. It is a fictional East African nation from the movie and the comic book Black Panther. And I suppose that you could say that the real Wakanda is actually right here, because Black Panther spent more than $80 million in production right here in Georgia. Is it okay for the Atlanta airport, a public facility, to basically promote a giant Hollywood film? Are we cool with this because it's kind of cute?
Oh, of course. It was fun. Look, Black Panther's a cultural phenomenon. It's shot right here in Georgia. Why not brag about the connection a little?
When it's a movie that good, absolutely. And I got to tell you, like, when I saw that, I was like, yo, I'm about to go to Hartsfield and be on the first plane to Wakanda.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it all. You know, it's great advertising because it should suggest the wonder of Wakanda as an aspirational destination, you know? And in that sense, it's great.
Yeah, celebrating
but
the fact
Greg,
that it was...
But Greg,
yeah.
Go ahead, Greg.
Oh, I was going to say, celebrating the fact that it was actually filmed here in Atlanta, generated nearly $90 million, you know, for the state. Unfortunately, about $50 million of that was sent back home to Wakanda, but I think it's certainly a great thing.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. The state of Georgia has really given its all to this movie in the form of the incredibly generous tax credit that was the reason they shot it here in the first place, right?
Yes. So, and that's one of the things that, as somebody that looks at the economy and says we shouldn't be picking winners and losers, the film tax credit has actually worked out because it is spread across a very diverse, it's not just picking one production company, it's giving it to the TV shows. In fact, I live near Tucker and the Clarkston border, and the show Good Girls, it's coming out on NBC, that's being filmed at my grocery store. And the money that, and you should see all the hubbub around there, and there's a bevy of folks there. I mean, it is a ton of money coming in, and these retail areas in that area certainly need the boost. So I've got to say that the jury has decided, and the film tax credit has worked wonders for Georgia.
It's good.
All right. Settled issue. I like that. here's something that I thought was going to be settled, but apparently it's not. Dating is supposed to be fun, right?
You're a good-looking man.
Thank you.
Very pretty. Real soft, delicate features. Real feminine, you know, which is good for me because that would be a simple sort of transition. You know what I'm saying? Maybe throw a little rouge on you. You game?
No.
Well, perhaps dating is not so great when you end up on a date with someone from an opposing ideology or political party. This is why some people have created a new dating service exclusively for Trump supporters. Greg, would you use it?
No. Like, well, especially now that I'm married, that would be really
well,
awkward.
Yeah, that's reason number one.
You know,
you would have a problem, a little problem.
You know
there.
What? I had to, in the Tinder app and the Trumper app, is that what they call it? I don't know, Trump singles. I would never go on just based on somebody's political ideology. There's many reasons not to do that. But unfortunately, the Trump dating site has already been inundated with liberal trolls. I've seen several of my Facebook friends claiming that they now have to go out on a cross-dressing date because somebody agreed to take them on the app. So, yeah, okay. It looks like the party's over for that site.
But here's the thing. So, you know, political allegiances, it's not just like, you know, I'm a fan of one sports team and you're a fan of another sports team. These are actually really significant, profound, substantive disagreements that people have with one another. And is not a system of essentially shared values going to be essential to any successful relationship?
Well, politics... Amber? Oh, sorry. Yeah. That was Natalie. I'll be quiet.
That was Natalie, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I hate that as a nation, you know, we're so divisive already. So I really hate the premise that we can't even date somebody who has conflicting political views. I wish we lived in a world where we could. However, at the same time, I wonder at this point, what would you talk about? Like, what would that dinner conversation be?
Reinforcement. In one word, reinforcement.
Maybe you're not having conversations. Maybe you're
no, you don't want a conversation. You just want somebody else to reinforce the notion that your views are the correct ones, which is rather
she
sad.
She was going a different direction with that, I think.
No, but look, politics and values do go hand in hand, right? And yeah. I dated a lot of Republicans back when I was single. I was actually a teenage Republican myself, if you can believe it. But
do you think about it each time you go out?
If I were single, could I date somebody who actually, you know, wholeheartedly supported Trump? No, I couldn't. And I think it's a sign of our divided times.
Yeah, that said, all human beings are social animals. They deserve a mate. So I think Trump supporters deserve each other. And, once they're together,
Trumpista babies.
You know, most likely they're so angry, they're going to start fighting between themselves.
I mean, I think that the Hillary supporters have shown themselves to be just as angry this past year. So let's not blame just the Trump folks.
Yeah, but he's dead.
What?
You said Hitler?
No, Hillary.
Oh, gosh.
I heard Hitler, too.
Sounded like Hitler.
You said Hitler.
I broke Godwin's law way too early.
Had a lapsus.
I said the Hillary supporters. Well, hey, you know, that's a Freudian slip, I suppose.
Yep.
Oh, boy. Okay.
All right.
Well, speaking of the president of America, not the Third Reich, another day, another tweet storm by President Trump. This week, one target was Oprah. He tweeted, quote, "Just watched a very insecure Oprah Winfrey, who at one point I knew very well, interview a panel of people on 60 Minutes. The questions were biased and slanted, the facts incorrect. Hope Oprah runs," presumably he means for president, "so that she can be exposed and defeated just like all of the others." Now, folks, certainly Trump has crossed a lot of people on Twitter. Is Oprah where the nation shall draw the line?
Oh, who can even keep up? I mean, seriously, the bully in chief has attacked half the country by now, right? What I love about this is Oprah's response, because what she did was actually took a second look at the segment she did for 60 Minutes to see if any President Whiny Pants' criticisms had merit. And I can't imagine him responding in a similar way.
No. And, you know, first of all, can I just point out, I know we're at this place where we just all accept this, but I just need to say, this is not normal presidential behavior. Like, it just needs to be reminded and reinforced that this is not normal. This is not how a president should behave. But because we've all just been so inundated with it and just kind of accepted, I think there will be little consequence to it because it's so frequently occurring now that everyone's just like, oh, so who did he attack now?
And, it's like, well,
this is hardly his most transgressive tweet.
Yeah, because our threshold has gone the way of...
Well, one has a right to respond to coverage of you that you feel is slanted.
One does. The president of the United States.
One also has the right to expect decent behavior from the president of the country. And we haven't received that in quite a while.
Super agree.
It's been at least 8 years. You're absolutely right.
Really?
You're going to go in that direction.
Insulting people on Twitter.
Yeah, right.
Like, get out of here.
Yeah.
Presidents just got raided. Trump, obviously, at the bottom of the list. Obama was among the top eight, I believe.
I have to question the source on that one.
Even the Republican historians involved in that, and it was about 170 who responded. Even the Republicans put him in the bottom five.
After first year results, with our economy going gangbusters, I think that history will shine a better image on Trump.
No way.
Let's get back to the point of the question, though, and it's about how you behave as president. In that regard, I am so disappointed in this guy. I kind of thought maybe when he came on, because he can be charming when he wants to be. He can rally a group. I thought he had, because he was untethered from kind of our normal politics. I was willing to give him a chance for a few months. Maybe he can craft a new path. But he has disappointed me again and again.
There was no way he was ever going to get a fair shake from anybody at this table.
If he bans AR-15s, I'll give him a fair shake.
Okay.
If he stops...
Will I ban AR-15s?
If he defends the country by accepting the findings on the Russia investigation and helping instead of hindering, then he'll get my vote. If he acts like a leader and not a divider, then he'll get my vote.
Yeah. I agree with Natalie.
Shall be seen.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Amber.
He lost it for me when he called African nations s-hole.
Yeah, there was that.
So there's kind of
no coming back from
so
that.
So what the question should be, when did you first get Trump derangement syndrome? And I think
yeah,
we found out
I'm glad you admit that he's deranged, Greg.
He's
that's real progress.
He's so many people. Yeah.
It's more an affliction for people that are
I know what you think
on living day-to-day through his tweets and hating life
when,
because
when
he's,
did,
he's
when
a mean
did part
person.
Of the presidential duties include offending half of the nation constantly?
I guess with Obama.
Nah.
I could just go back to our most recent president.
With all seriousness, as divided as we may be in our politics, you cannot sit here with a straight face and say that Obama was as rude and embarrassing and unpresidential in his demeanor.
Certainly,
you can't compare
Obama
those
was
two.
More rehearsed,
perhaps not explicitly.
Yes, he was more rehearsed and had more eloquent language, but
The
idea that he was less divisive than Trump,
really?
I think.
Obama offended half of the nation. Really going to fly that?
Offended half of the nation.
Even if he offended anybody, statistically, that doesn't compute at all.
Okay.
I think.
Okay, good talk.
All right.
Let's go ahead and let some of our listeners weigh in here on some of the things that we've been talking about. This is a Facebook post from Leonard Henry, who was going back to our conversation about gun control following the school shooting in Florida. Leonard writes, "Our constitutional rights and freedoms are not based on what we think we need. We don't need cars with more than 50 HP that travel more than horsepower." Hey, God, I'm such a man. Such a man.
Hewlett-Packard?
50 HP that can travel more than 55 miles per hour. Think of all the lives regulating cars would save. Don't like gun ownership? Fine. Get the signatures you need nationwide to have a constitutional referendum repealing the Second Amendment. See how far that gets. Also on Facebook, Monique writes about Fergie's rendition of the national anthem. "If I never hear that awful version of the Star-Spangled Banner again, it will be too soon. It's the national anthem. It's not a performance piece. We should stop inviting people to lead the anthem with the notion that the purpose is for them to perform and entertain everyone." That's from Monique in Savannah. So, folks, I think we'll go ahead and leave it there. We'll let our guests have the last word. Certainly, y'all have gotten in plenty this time, which is great. That's great. I'm very, very happy. Amber Scott is executive director of the nonprofit Leap Year. Hector Fernandez is a professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. Natalie Pavelski is vice president of Cater Communications. And Greg Williams is a mortgage banker and host of the radio show Greg's List. Thank you all. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thanks, Adam. And you guys have a great weekend.
A great weekend, everybody.
We're going to hug it out later.
Indeed, I hope so. That's our show for today. As always, listeners, we really want to know what you have to say. Hope that you chime in with reactions to anything that you have heard in today's program. Give us a call at 404-500-9457, 404-500-9457. And I'm going to ask you kind of a meta question now. Sure, please weigh in on any of the controversial issues that we discussed. But the other thing I'm curious about is, do you want more public radio like the kind that you just heard, that's a little bit more lively, confrontational, oppositional, people getting heated with each other, talking over each other with great passion? Or do you more prefer the traditional public radio, nice, staid, quiet, one person speaking at a time, everyone observing manners, et cetera, et cetera? I'm honestly curious what your feeling on that question is. Let us know at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OST Talk. You can find our Facebook page. It's On Second Thought right there on the Facebook. For today and for the week, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have yourself a good weekend.